had set out upon together, and which he now knew he would have to journey alone. There might still be as many as 4 Horcruxes out there somewhere, and each would need to be found and eliminated before there was even a possibility that Voldemort could be killed. He kept reciting their names to himself, as though by listing them he could bring them within reach. The locket, the cup, the snake, something of Gryffindor's or Ravenclaw's. The locket, the cup, the snake, something of Gryffindor's or Ravenclaw's. This mantra seemed to pulse through Harry's mind as he fell asleep at night, and his dreams were thick with cups, lockets, and mysterious objects that he could not quite reach, though Dumbledore helpfully offered Harry a rope ladder that turned to snakes the moment he began to climb. He had shown Hermione the note inside the locket the morning after Dumbledore's death, and although she had not immediately recognized the initials as belonging to some obscure wizard about whom she had been reading, she has since been rushing off to the library a little more often than was strictly necessary for somebody who had no homework to do.
"No," she said sadly. "I've been trying, Harry, but I haven't found anything. There are a couple of reasonably well-known wizards with those initials. Rosalind Antigone Bungs, Rupert Axbanger Brooke Stanton, but they don't seem to fit at all. Judging by that note, the person who stole the Horcrux knew Voldemort. And I can't find a shred of evidence that Bungs or Axbanger ever had anything to do with him. No, actually, it's about, well, Snape."
She looked nervous, even saying the name again. "What about him?" asked Harry heavily, slumping back in his chair.
"Well, it's just that I was sort of right about the Half-Blood Prince business," she said tentatively.
"Do you have to rub it in, Hermione? How do you think I feel about that now?"
"No, no, Harry, I didn't mean that," she said hastily, looking around to check that they were not being overheard. "It's just that I was right about Eileen Prince once owning the book. You see, she was Snape's mother."
"I thought she wasn't much of a looker," said Ron. Hermione ignored him.
"I was going through the rest of the old prophets, and there was a tiny announcement about Eileen Prince marrying a man called Tobias Snape, and then later an announcement saying that she'd given birth to a..."
"Murderer," spat Harry.
"Well, yes," said Hermione. "So, I was sort of right. Snape must have been proud of being half a prince, you see. Tobias Snape was a muggle, from what is said in the prophet."
"Yeah, that fits," said Harry. "He'd play up the pure blood side so he could get in with Lucius Malfoy and the rest of them. He's just like Voldemort, pure blood mother, muggle father, ashamed of his parentage, trying to make himself feared using the dark arts, gave himself an impressive new name, Lord Voldemort. The Half-Blood Prince. How could Dumbledore have missed?"
He broke off, looking out the window. He could not stop himself dwelling upon Dumbledore's inexcusable trust in Snape. But as Hermione had just inadvertently reminded him, he, Harry, had been taken in just the same. In spite of the increasing nastiness of those scribbled spells, he had refused to believe ill of the boy who had been so clever, who had helped him so much.
Helped him? It was an almost unendurable thought now.
"I still don't get why he didn't turn you in for using that book," said Ron. "He must have known where you were getting it all from."
"He knew," said Harry bitterly. "He knew when I used Sectum Sempra. He didn't really need legilimency. He might even have known before then, with Slughorn talking about how brilliant I was at potions. Shouldn't have left his old book in the bottom of that cupboard, should he?"
"But why didn't he turn you in?"
"I don't think he wanted to associate himself with that book," said Hermione. "I don't think Dumbledore would have liked it very much if he'd known. And even if Snape pretended it hadn't been his, Slughorn would have recognized his writing at once. Anyway, the book was left in Snape's old classroom, and I'll bet Dumbledore knew his mother was called Prince."
"I should have shown the book to Dumbledore," said Harry.
"All that time he was showing me how Voldemort was evil, even when he was at school, and I had proof Snape was, too."
"Evil is a strong word," said Hermione quietly.
"You were the one who kept telling me the book was dangerous."
"I'm trying to say, Harry, that you're putting too much blame on yourself, I thought the prince seemed to have a nasty sense of humor, but I would never have guessed he was a potential killer.
None of us could have guessed Snape would, you know, said Ron.
Silence fell between them, each of them lost in their own thoughts, but Harry was sure that they, like him, were thinking about the following morning, when Dumbledore's body would be laid to rest. He had never attended a funeral before. There had been no body to bury when Sirius had died. He did not know what to expect, and was a little worried about what he might see, about how he would feel. He wondered whether Dumbledore's death would be more real to him once it was over. Though he had moments when the horrible fact of it threatened to overwhelm him, there were blank stretches of numbness where, despite the fact that nobody was talking about anything else in the whole castle, he still found it difficult to believe that Dumbledore had really gone. Admittedly, he had not, as he had with Sirius, looked desperately for some kind of loophole, some way that Dumbledore would come back. He felt in his pocket for the cold chain of the fake Horcrux, which he now carried with him everywhere, not as a talisman, but as a reminder of what it had cost and what remained still to do. Harry rose early to pack the next day. The Hogwarts Express would be leaving an hour after the funeral. Downstairs he found the mood in the great hall subdued. Everybody was wearing their dress robes, and no one seemed very hungry. Professor McGonagall had left the throne-like chair in the middle of the staff table empty. Hagrid's chair was deserted, too. Harry thought that perhaps he had not been able to face breakfast. But Snape's place had been unceremoniously filled by Rufus Scrimgeour. Harry avoided his yellowish eyes as they scanned the hall. Harry had the uncomfortable feeling that Scrimgeour was looking for him. Among Scrimgeour's entourage, Harry spotted the red hair and horn-rimmed glasses of Percy Weasley. Ron gave no sign that he was aware of Percy, apart from stabbing pieces of kipper with unwanted venom. Over at the Slytherin table, Crabbe and Goyle were muttering together. Hulking boys though they were, they looked oddly lonely without the tall, pale figure of Malfoy between them, bossing them around. Harry had not spared Malfoy much thought. His animosity was all for Snape, but he had not forgotten the fear in Malfoy's voice on that tower top, nor the fact that he had lowered his wand before the other Death Eaters arrived. Harry did not believe that Malfoy would have killed Dumbledore. He despised Malfoy still for his infatuation with the dark arts, but now the tiniest drop of pity mingled with his dislike. Where, Harry wondered, was Malfoy now? And what was Voldemort making him do under threat of killing him and his parents? Harry's thoughts were interrupted by a nudge in the ribs from Ginny. Professor McGonagall had risen to her feet, and the mournful hum in the hall died away at once.
"It is nearly time," she said. "Please follow your heads of houses out into the grounds. Gryffindors, after me."
They filed out from behind their benches in near silence. Harry glimpsed Slughorn at the head of the Slytherin column, wearing magnificent long emerald-green robes embroidered with silver. He had never seen Professor Sprout, head of the Hufflepuffs, looking so clean. There was not a single patch on her hat, and when they reached the entrance hall, they found Madam Pince standing beside Filch, she in a thick black veil that fell to her knees, he in an ancient black suit and tie, reeking of mothballs. They were heading, as Harry saw when he stepped out onto the stone steps from the front doors, toward the lake. The warmth of the sun caressed his face as they followed Professor McGonagall in silence to the place where hundreds of chairs had been set out in rows. An aisle ran down the center of them. There was a marble table standing at the front, all chairs facing it. It was the most beautiful summer's day. An extraordinary assortment of people had already settled into half of the chairs, shabby and smart, old and young. Most Harry did not recognize, but a few he did, including members of the Order of the Phoenix. Kingsley Shacklebolt, Mad-Eye Moody, Tonks, her hair miraculously returned to vividest pink. Remus Lupin, with whom she seemed to be holding hands. Mr. and Mrs. Weasley. Bill, supported by Fleur and followed by Fred and George, who were wearing jackets of black dragon skin. Then there was Madame Maxime, who took up 2.5 chairs on her own. Tom, the landlord of the Leaky Cauldron in London. Arabella Fig,
Harry's squib neighbor, the hairy bass player from the wizarding group The Weird Sisters, Ernie Prang, driver of the night bus, Madame Malkin of the robe shop in Diagon Alley, and some people whom Harry merely knew by sight, such as the barman of the Hog's Head and the witch who pushed the trolley on the Hogwarts Express. The castle ghosts were there too, barely visible in the bright sunlight, discernible only when they moved, shimmering, insubstantially on the gleaming air. Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Ginny filed into seats at the end of a row beside the lake. People were whispering to each other. It sounded like a breeze in the grass, but the birdsong was louder by far. The crowd continued to swell. With a great rush of affection for both of them, Harry saw Neville being helped into a seat by Luna. Neville and Luna alone of the DA had responded to Hermione's summons the night that Dumbledore had died, and Harry knew why. They were the ones who had missed the DA most, probably the ones who had checked their coins regularly in the hope that there would be another meeting. Cornelius Fudge walked past toward the front rows, his expression miserable, twirling his green bowler hat as usual. Harry next recognized Rita Skeeter, who, he was infuriated to see, had a notebook clutched in her red taloned hand, and then, with a worse jolt of fury, Dolores Umbridge, an unconvincing expression of grief upon her toad-like face, a black velvet bow set atop her iron-colored curls. At the sight of the centaur Firenze, who was standing like a sentinel near the water's edge, she gave a start and scurried hastily into a seat a good distance away. The staff was seated at last. Harry could see Scrimgeour looking grave and dignified in the front row with Professor McGonagall. He wondered whether Scrimgeour, or any of these important people, were really sorry that Dumbledore was dead. But then he heard music, strange, otherworldly music, and he forgot his dislike of the ministry in looking around for the source of it. He was not the only one. Many heads were turning, searching, a little alarmed.
"In there,"
whispered Ginny in Harry's ear. And he saw them in the clear, green, sunlit water, inches below the surface, reminding him horribly of the Inferi. A chorus of merpeople singing in a strange language he did not understand, their pallid faces rippling, their purplish hair flowing all around them. The music made the hair on Harry's neck stand up, and yet it was not unpleasant. It spoke very clearly of loss and of despair. As he looked down into the wild faces of the singers, he had the feeling that they, at least, were sorry for Dumbledore's passing. Then Ginny nudged him again, and he looked around. Hagrid was walking slowly up the aisle between the chairs. He was crying quite silently, his face gleaming with tears, and in his arms, wrapped in purple velvet spangled with golden stars, was what Harry knew to be Dumbledore's body. A sharp pain rose in Harry's throat at this sight. For a moment, the strange music and the knowledge that Dumbledore's body was so close seemed to take all warmth from the day. Ron looked white and shocked. Tears were falling thick and fast into both Ginny's and Hermione's laps. They could not see clearly what was happening at the front. Hagrid seemed to have placed the body carefully upon the table. Now he retreated down the aisle, blowing his nose with loud trumpeting noises that drew scandalized looks from some, including, Harry saw, Dolores Umbridge. But Harry knew that Dumbledore would not have cared. He tried to make a friendly gesture to Hagrid as he passed, but Hagrid's eyes were so swollen it was a wonder he could see where he was going. Harry glanced at the back row to which Hagrid was heading and realized what was guiding him. For there, dressed in a jacket and trousers each the size of a small marquee, was the giant Grawp, his great, ugly, boulder-like head bowed, docile, almost human. Hagrid sat down next to his half-brother, and Grawp patted Hagrid hard on the head so that his chair legs sank into the ground. Harry had a wonderful momentary urge to laugh, but then the music stopped, and he turned to face the front again. A little tufty-haired man in plain black robes had got to his feet and stood now in front of Dumbledore's body. Harry could not hear what he was saying. Odd words floated back to them over the hundreds of heads. Nobility of spirit, intellectual contribution, greatness of heart. It did not mean very much. It had little to do with Dumbledore as Harry had known him. He suddenly remembered Dumbledore's idea of a few words: nitwit, oddment, blubber, and tweak, and again had to suppress a grin. What was the matter with him? There was a soft splashing noise to his left, and he saw that the merpeople had broken the surface to listen to. He remembered Dumbledore crouching at the water's edge 2 years ago, very close to where Harry now sat, and conversing in Mermish with the mer-chieftainess. Harry wondered where Dumbledore had learned Mermish. There was so much he had never asked him, so much he should have said. And then, without warning, it swept over him, the dreadful truth, more completely and undeniably than it had until now. Dumbledore was dead. Gone. He clutched the cold locket in his hands so tightly that it hurt, but he could not prevent hot tears spilling from his eyes. He looked away from Ginny and the others and stared out over the lake toward the forest as the little man in black droned on. There was movement among the trees. The centaurs had come to pay their respects too. They did not move into the open. But Harry saw them standing quite still, half hidden in shadow, watching the wizards, their bows hanging at their sides. And Harry remembered his first nightmarish trip into the forest, the first time he had ever encountered the thing that was then Voldemort, and how he had faced him, and how he and Dumbledore had discussed fighting a losing battle not long thereafter. It was important, Dumbledore said, to fight, and fight again, and keep fighting. For only then could evil be kept at bay, though never quite eradicated. And Harry saw very clearly as he sat there under the hot sun how people who cared about him had stood in front of him one by one. His mother, his father, his godfather, and finally Dumbledore, all determined to protect him. But now that was over. He could not let anybody else stand between him and Voldemort. He must abandon forever the illusion he ought to have lost at the age of one, that the shelter of a parent's arms meant that nothing could hurt him. There was no waking from his nightmare, no comforting whisper in the dark that he was safe, really, that it was all in his imagination. The last and greatest of his protectors had died, and he was more alone than he had ever been before. The little man in black had stopped speaking at last and resumed his seat. Harry waited for somebody else to get to their feet. He expected speeches, probably from the minister, but nobody moved. Then several people screamed. Bright white flames had erupted around Dumbledore's body and the table upon which it lay. Higher and higher they rose, obscuring the body. White smoke spiraled into the air and made strange shapes. Harry thought for one heart-stopping moment that he saw a phoenix fly joyfully into the blue. But next second the fire had vanished. In its place was a white marble tomb, encasing Dumbledore's body and the table on which he had rested. There were a few more cries of shock, as a shower of arrows soared through the air, but they fell far short of the crowd. It was, Harry knew, the centaur's tribute. He saw them turn tail and disappear back into the cool trees. Likewise, the mer-people sank slowly back into the green water and were lost from view. Harry looked at Ginny, Ron, and Hermione. Ron's face was screwed up as though the sunlight were blinding him. Hermione's face was glazed with tears, but Ginny was no longer crying. She met Harry's gaze with the same hard, blazing look that he had seen when she had hugged him after winning the Quidditch Cup in his absence, and he knew that at that moment, they understood each other perfectly, and that when he told her what he was going to do now, she would not say, "Be careful," or "Don't do it," but accept his decision, because she would not have expected anything less of him. And so he steeled himself to say what he had known he must say ever since Dumbledore had died. "Ginny, listen," he said very quietly, as the buzz of conversation grew louder around them and people began to get to their feet. "I can't be involved with you any more. We've got to stop seeing each other. We can't be together." She said, with an oddly twisted smile, "It's for some stupid, noble reason, isn't it?"
It's been like something out of someone else's life these last few weeks with you, said Harry. But I can't. We can't. I've got things to do alone now.
She did not cry. She simply looked at him.
Voldemort uses people his enemies are close to. He's already used you as bait once, and that was just because you're my best friend's sister. Think how much danger you'll be in if we keep this up. He'll know. He'll find out. He'll try and get to me through you.
What if I don't care? Said Ginny fiercely.
I care, said Harry. How do you think I'd feel if this was your funeral and it was my fault?
She looked away from him over the lake.
I never really gave up on you, she said. Not really. I always hoped.
Hermione told me to get on with life, maybe go out with some other people, relax a bit around you, because I never used to be able to talk if you were in the room, remember? And she thought you might take a bit more notice if I was a bit more myself.
Smart girl, that Hermione, said Harry, trying to smile.
I just wish I'd asked you sooner. We could have had ages, months, years, maybe.
But you've been too busy saving the wizarding world, said Ginny, half laughing.
Well, I can't say I'm surprised. I knew this would happen in the end. I knew you wouldn't be happy unless you were hunting Voldemort. Maybe that's why I like you so much.
Harry could not bear to hear these things, nor did he think his resolution would hold if he remained sitting beside her. Ron, he saw, was now holding Hermione and stroking her hair while she sobbed into his shoulder, tears dripping from the end of his own long nose. With a miserable gesture, Harry got up, turned his back on Ginny and on Dumbledore's tomb, and walked away around the lake. Moving felt much more bearable than sitting still. Just as setting out as soon as possible to track down the Horcruxes and kill Voldemort would feel better than waiting to do it.
Harry!
He turned. Rufus Scrimgeour was limping rapidly toward him around the bank, leaning on his walking stick.
I've been hoping to have a word. Do you mind if I walk a little way with you?
No, said Harry indifferently, and set off again.
Harry... This was a dreadful tragedy, said Scrimgeour quietly. I cannot tell you how appalled I was to hear of it. Dumbledore was a very great wizard. We had our disagreements, as you know, but no one knows better than I.
What do you want? Asked Harry flatly. Scrimgeour looked annoyed, but as before, hastily modified his expression to one of sorrowful understanding.
You are, of course, devastated, he said. I know that you were very close to Dumbledore. I think you may have been his favourite pupil ever. The bond between the two of you.
What do you want? Harry repeated, coming to a halt. Scrimgeour stopped too, leaned on his stick and stared at Harry, his expression shrewd now.
The word is that you were with him when he left the school the night that he died.
Whose word? Said Harry.
Somebody stupefied a Death Eater on top of the tower after Dumbledore died. There were also two broomsticks up there. The Ministry can add two and two, Harry.
Glad to hear it, said Harry.
Well, where I went with Dumbledore and what we did is my business. He didn't want people to know. Such loyalty is admirable, of course, said Scrimgeour, who seemed to be restraining his irritation with difficulty. But Dumbledore is gone, Harry. He's gone.
He will only be gone from the school when none here are loyal to him, said Harry, smiling in spite of himself.
My dear boy, even Dumbledore cannot return from the...
I am not saying he can. You wouldn't understand. But I've got nothing to tell you. Scrimgeour hesitated, then said in what was evidently supposed to be a tone of delicacy,
The Ministry can offer you all sorts of protection, you know, Harry. I would be delighted to place a couple of my aurors at your service.
Harry laughed. Voldemort wants to kill me himself, and aurors won't stop him, so thanks for the offer, but no thanks.
So, said Scrimgeour, his voice cold now, the request I made of you at Christmas.
What request?
Oh, yeah, The one where I tell the world what a great job you're doing in exchange for...
For raising everyone's morale,
snapped Scrimgeour. Harry considered him for a moment.
Released Stan Shunpike yet?
Scrimgeour turned a nasty purple colour, highly reminiscent of Uncle Vernon.
I see. You are...
Dumbledore's man, through and through, said Harry.
That's right.
Scrimgeour glared at him for another moment, then turned and limped away without another word. Harry could see Percy and the rest of the Ministry delegation waiting for him, casting nervous glances at the sobbing Hagrid and Grawp, who were still in their seats. Ron and Hermione were hurrying toward Harry, passing Scrimgeour going in the opposite direction. Harry turned and walked slowly on, waiting for them to catch up, which they finally did in the shade of a beech tree, under which they had sat in happier times.
"What did Scrimgeour want?" Hermione whispered.
"Same as he wanted at Christmas," shrugged Harry. "Wanted me to give him inside information on Dumbledore and be the Ministry's new poster boy." Ron seemed to struggle with himself for a moment, then he said loudly to Hermione,
"Look, let me go back and hit Percy."
"No,"
she said firmly, grabbing his arm.
"It'll make me feel better."
Harry laughed. Even Hermione grinned a little, though her smile faded as she looked up at the castle.
"I can't bear the idea that we might never come back," she said softly. "How can Hogwarts close?"
"Maybe it won't," said Ron. "We're not in any more danger here than we are at home, are we? Everywhere's the same now. I'd even say Hogwarts is safer. There are more wizards inside to defend the place. What do you reckon, Harry?"
"I'm not coming back, even if it does reopen," said Harry. Ron gaped at him, but Hermione said sadly,
"I knew you were going to say that. But then what will you do?"
"I'm going back to the Dursleys once more because Dumbledore wanted me to," said Harry. "But it'll be a short visit and then I'll be gone for good."
"But where will you go if you don't come back to school?"
"I thought I might go back to Godric's Hollow," Harry muttered. He had had the idea in his head ever since the night of Dumbledore's death.
"For me, it started there, all of it. I've just got a feeling I need to go there. And I can visit my parents' graves. I'd like that."
"And then what?" said Ron.
"Then I've got to track down the rest of the Horcruxes, haven't I?" said Harry, his eyes upon Dumbledore's white tomb, reflected in the water on the other side of the lake. "That's what he wanted me to do. That's why he told me all about them. If Dumbledore was right, and I'm sure he was, there are still four of them out there. I've got to find them and destroy them, and then I've got to go after the seventh bit of Voldemort's soul, the bit that's still in his body, and I'm the one who's going to kill him. And if I meet Severus Snape along the way," he added, "so much the better for me, so much the worse for him." There was a long silence. The crowd had almost dispersed now, the stragglers giving the monumental figure of Grawp a wide berth as he cuddled Hagrid, whose howls of grief were still echoing across the water.
"We'll be there, Harry,"
said Ron.
"What?" "At your aunt and uncle's house,"
said Ron.
"And then we'll go with you, wherever you're going."
"No," said Harry quickly. He had not counted on this. He had meant them to understand that he was undertaking this most dangerous journey alone.
"You said to us once before," said Hermione quietly, "that there was time to turn back if we wanted to. We've had time, haven't we?"
"We're with you, whatever happens," said Ron.
"But, mate, you're going to have to come round my mum and dad's house before we do anything else, even Godric's Hollow."
"Why?"
"Bill and Fleur's wedding, remember?"
Harry looked at him, startled. The idea that anything as normal as a wedding could still exist seemed incredible. And yet wonderful.
"Yeah, we shouldn't miss that," he said finally.
His hand closed automatically around the fake Horcrux, but in spite of everything, in spite of the dark and twisting path he saw stretching ahead for himself, in spite of the final meeting with Voldemort he knew must come, whether in a month, in a year, or in 10,
He felt his heart lift at the thought that there was still one last golden day of peace left to enjoy with Ron and Hermione.
Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince was read by Jim Dale. Text copyright J.K. Rowling 2005. Recording copyright Listening Library 2005. An imprint of the Penguin Random House Audio Publishing Group. Digitally remastered by Pottermore at Pinewood Studios in 2015. Pottermore is the digital entertainment, news and e-commerce company from J.K. Rowling, inspired by her Harry Potter books and the wider wizarding world. Pottermore is a place for Harry Potter fans to be entertained and discover more of the wizarding world they love through Pottermore.com experiences or products including Harry Potter ebooks, digital audiobooks and more. Harry Potter characters, names and related indicia are trademarks and copyright of Warner Brothers Entertainment. The story continues. Find out what happens next in this preview of the digital audiobook Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows by J.K. Rowling. Text copyright J.K. Rowling 2007. Recording copyright Listening Library 2007. An imprint of the Penguin Random House Audio Publishing Group.
Chapter 1. The Dark Lord Ascending. The two men appeared out of nowhere, a few yards apart in the narrow, moonlit lane. For a second, they stood quite still, wands directed at each other's chests. Then, recognizing each other, they stowed their wands beneath their cloaks and started walking briskly in the same direction.
"News?" asked the taller of the two.
"The best," replied Severus Snape.
The lane was bordered on the left by wild, low-growing brambles, on the right by a high, neatly manicured hedge. The men's long cloaks flapped around their ankles as they marched.
"Thought I might be late," said Yaxley,
his blunt features sliding in and out of sight as the branches of overhanging trees broke the moonlight.
"It was a little trickier than I expected, but I hope he will be satisfied. You sound confident that your reception will be good."
Snape nodded, but did not elaborate. They turned right into a wide driveway that led off the lane. The high hedge curved with them, running off into the distance beyond the pair of impressive wrought-iron gates barring the men's way. Neither of them broke step. In silence, both raised their left arms in a kind of salute and passed straight through, as though the dark metal were smoke. The yew hedges muffled the sound of the men's footsteps. There was a rustle somewhere to their right. Yaxley drew his wand again, pointing it over his companion's head, but the source of the noise proved to be nothing more than a pure white peacock strutting majestically along the top of the hedge.
"He always did himself well, Lucius. Peacocks."
Yaxley thrust his wand back under his cloak with a snort. A handsome manor house grew out of the darkness at the end of the straight drive, lights glinting in the diamond-paned downstairs windows. Somewhere in the dark garden beyond the hedge, a fountain was playing. Gravel crackled beneath their feet as Snape and Yaxley sped toward the front door, which swung inward at their approach, though nobody had visibly opened it. The hallway was large, dimly lit, and sumptuously decorated, with a magnificent carpet covering most of the stone floor. The eyes of the pale-faced portraits on the walls followed Snape and Yaxley as they strode past. The two men halted at a heavy wooden door leading into the next room, hesitated for the space of a heartbeat, then Snape turned the bronze handle. The drawing room was full of silent people, sitting at a long and ornate table. The room's usual furniture had been pushed carelessly up against the walls. Illumination came from a roaring fire beneath a handsome marble mantelpiece surmounted by a gilded mirror. Snape and Yaxley lingered for a moment on the threshold. As their eyes grew accustomed to the lack of light, they were drawn upward to the strangest feature of the scene. an apparently unconscious human figure hanging upside down over the table, revolving slowly as if suspended by an invisible rope, and reflected in the mirror and in the bare, polished surface of the table below. None of the people seated underneath this singular sight was looking at it except for a pale young man, sitting almost directly below it. He seemed unable to prevent himself from glancing upward every minute or so.
"Yuxley! Snape!"
said a high, clear voice from the head of the table.
"You are very nearly late."
The speaker was seated directly in front of the fireplace, so that it was difficult, at first, for the new arrivals to make out more than his silhouette. As they drew nearer, however, his face shone through the gloom, hairless, snake-like, with slits for nostrils and gleaming red eyes whose pupils were vertical. He was so pale that he seemed to emit a pearly glow.
"Severus, here!"
said Voldemort, indicating the seat on his immediate right.
"Yuxley, beside Dolohov."
The two men took their allotted places. Most of the eyes around the table followed Snape, and it was to him that Voldemort spoke first.
"So?"
"My lord, the Order of the Phoenix intends to move Harry Potter from his current place of safety on Saturday next, at nightfall."
The interest around the table sharpened palpably. Some stiffened, others fidgeted, all gazing at Snape and Voldemort.
"Saturday at nightfall,"
repeated Voldemort. His red eyes fastened upon Snape's black ones with such intensity that some of the watchers looked away, apparently fearful that they themselves would be scorched by the ferocity of the gaze. Snape, however, looked calmly back into Voldemort's face, and after a moment or two, Voldemort's lipless mouth curved into something like a smile.
"Good. Very good. And this information comes..."
"From the source we discussed," said Snape.
"My lord?"
Yaxley had leaned forward to look down the long table at Voldemort and Snape, all faces turned to him.
"My lord, I have heard differently."
Yaxley waited, but Voldemort did not speak, so he went on.
"Dawlish, the Auror, let slip that Potter will not be moved until the 30th, the night before the boy turns 17.
Snape was smiling.
"My source told me that there are plans to lay a false trail. This must be it. No doubt a confundus charm has been placed upon Dawlish. It would not be the first time. He is known to be susceptible."
"I assure you, my lord, Dawlish seemed quite certain," said Yaxley.
"If he has been confounded, naturally he is certain," said Snape. "I assure you, Yaxley, the Auror office will play no further part in the protection of Harry Potter. The Order believes that we have infiltrated the Ministry."
"The Order's got one thing right then, eh?"
said a squat man sitting a short distance from Yaxley. He gave a wheezy giggle that was echoed here and there along the table. Voldemort did not laugh. His gaze had wandered upward to the body revolving slowly overhead, and he seemed to be lost in thought.
"My lord,"
Yaxley went on,
"Dawlish believes an entire party of Aurors will be used to transfer the boy."
Voldemort held up a large white hand, and Yaxley subsided at once, watching resentfully as Voldemort turned back to Snape.
"Where are they going to hide the boy next?"
"At the home of one of the Order," said Snape. "The place, according to the source, has been given every protection that the Order and Ministry together could provide. I think that there is little chance of taking him once he is there, my lord. Unless, of course, the Ministry has fallen before next Saturday, which might give us the opportunity to discover and undo enough of the enchantments to break through the rest.
Well, Yexley,
Voldemort called down the table, the firelight glinting strangely in his red eyes.
Will the ministry have fallen by next Saturday?
Once again, all heads turned. Yexley squared his shoulders.
My lord, I have good news on that score. I have, with difficulty and after great effort, succeeded in placing an imperious curse upon Pious Thickness.
Many of those sitting around Yaxley looked impressed. His neighbour Dolohov, a man with a long, twisted face, clapped him on the back.
It is a start, said Voldemort. But Thickness is only one man. Scrimgeour must be surrounded by our people before I act. One failed attempt on the minister's life will set me back a long way.
Yes, my lord, that is true. But, you know, as head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement, Thickness has regular contact not only with the minister himself, but also with the heads of all the other ministry departments. It will, I think, be easy now that we have such a high-ranking official under our control to subjugate the others, and then they can all work together to bring Scrimgeour down.
As long as our friend Thickness is not discovered before he has converted the rest,
said Voldemort.
At any rate, it remains unlikely that the ministry will be mine before next Saturday. If we cannot touch the boy at his destination, then it must be done while he travels.
We are at an advantage there, my lord, said Yaxley, who seemed determined to receive some portion of approval. We now have several people planted within the Department of Magical Transport. If Potter apparates or uses the flu network, we shall know immediately.
He will not do either, said Snape. The Order is eschewing any form of transport that is controlled or regulated by the Ministry. They mistrust everything to do with the place. All the better, said Voldemort. He will have to move in the open. Easier to take by far.
Again, Voldemort looked up at the slowly revolving body as he went on.
I shall attend to the boy in person. There have been too many mistakes where Harry Potter is concerned. Some of them have been my own. That Potter lives is due more to my errors than to his triumphs.
The company around the table watched Voldemort apprehensively, each of them, by his or her expression, afraid that they might be blamed for Harry Potter's continued existence. Voldemort, however, seemed to be speaking more to himself than to any of them, still addressing the unconscious body above him.
I have been careless, and so have been thwarted by luck and chance, those wreckers of all but the best-laid plans. But I know better now. I understand those things that I did not understand before. I must be the one to kill Harry Potter, and I shall be.
At these words, seemingly in response to them, a sudden wail sounded, a terrible, drawn-out cry of misery and pain. Many of those at the table looked downward, startled, for the sound had seemed to issue from below their feet.
Wormtail, said Voldemort,
with no change in his quiet, thoughtful tone, and without removing his eyes from the revolving body above.
Have I not spoken to you about keeping our prisoner quiet? Yes, my lord,
gasped the small man, halfway down the table, who had been sitting so low in his chair that it had appeared at first glance to be unoccupied. Now he scrambled from his seat and scurried from the room, leaving nothing behind him but a curious gleam of silver.
As I was saying,
continued Voldemort, looking again at the tense faces of his followers,
I understand better now. I shall need, for instance, to borrow a wand from one of you before I go to kill Potter.
The faces around him displayed nothing but shock. He might have announced that he wanted to borrow one of their arms.
"No volunteers," said Voldemort. "Let's see. Lucius, I see no reason for you to have a wand anymore."
Lucius Malfoy looked up. His skin appeared yellowish and waxy in the firelight, and his eyes were sunken and shadowed. When he spoke, his voice was hoarse.
"My lord."
"Your wand, Lucius. I require your wand."
"I..."
Malfoy glanced sideways at his wife. She was staring straight ahead, quite as pale as he was, her long blonde hair hanging down her back. But beneath the table, her slim fingers closed briefly on his wrist. At her touch, Malfoy put his hand into his robes, withdrew a wand, and passed it along to Voldemort, who held it up in front of his red eyes, examining it closely.
"What is it?"
"Helm, my lord," whispered Malfoy.
"And the core?"
"Dragon. Dragon heartstring."
"Good,"
said Voldemort. He drew out his own wand and compared the lengths. Lucius Malfoy made an involuntary movement. For a fraction of a second, it seemed he expected to receive Voldemort's wand in exchange for his own. The gesture was not missed by Voldemort, whose eyes widened maliciously.
"Give you my wand, Lucius? My wand?"
Some of the throng sniggered.
"I have given you your liberty, Lucius. Is that not enough for you? But I have noticed that you and your family seem less than happy of late. What is it about my presence in your home that displeases you, Lucius?"
"Nothing. Nothing, my lord."
"Such lies, Lucius."
The soft voice seemed to hiss on, even after the cruel mouth had stopped moving. One or two of the wizards barely repressed a shudder as the hissing grew louder. Something heavy could be heard sliding across the floor beneath the table. The huge snake emerged to climb slowly up Voldemort's chair. It rose seemingly endlessly and came to rest across Voldemort's shoulders, its neck the thickness of a man's thigh, its eyes, with their vertical slits for pupils, unblinking. Voldemort stroked the creature absently with long, thin fingers, still looking at Lucius Malfoy.
"Why do the Malfoys look so unhappy with their lot? Is my return, my rise to power, not the very thing they profess to desire for so many years?"
"Of course, my lord,"
said Lucius Malfoy. His hands shook as he wiped sweat from his upper lip.
"We did desire it. We do!"
To Malfoy's left, his wife made an odd, stiff nod, her eyes averted from Voldemort and the snake. To his right, his son Draco, who had been gazing up at the inert body overhead, glanced quickly at Voldemort and away again, terrified to make eye contact.
"My lord,"
said a dark woman halfway down the table, her voice constricted with emotion.
"It is an honor to have you here in our family's house. There can be no higher pleasure."
She sat beside her sister, as unlike her in looks, with her dark hair and heavily lidded eyes, as she was in bearing and demeanor. Where Narcissa sat rigid and impassive, Bellatrix leaned toward Voldemort, for mere words could not demonstrate her longing for closeness.
"No higher pleasure,"
repeated Voldemort, his head tilted a little to one side as he considered Bellatrix.
"That means a great deal, Bellatrix, from you."
Her face flooded with color, her eyes welled with tears of delight.
"My lord knows I speak nothing but the truth."
"No higher pleasure, even compared with the happy event that I hear has taken place in your family this week."
She stared at him, her lips parted, evidently confused.
"I don't know what you mean, my lord.
I'm talking about your niece, Bellatrix, and yours, Lucius Narcissa. She has just married the werewolf, Remus Lupin. You must be so proud.
There was an eruption of jeering laughter from around the table. Many leaned forward to exchange gleeful looks. A few thumped the table with their fists. The great snake, disliking the disturbance, opened its mouth wide and hissed angrily. But the Death Eaters did not hear it, so jubilant were they at Bellatrix and the Malfoy's humiliation. Bellatrix's face, so recently flushed with happiness, had turned an ugly, blotchy red.
"She is no niece of ours, my lord,"
she cried over the outpouring of mirth.
"We, Narcissa and I, have never set eyes on our sister since she married the Mudblood. This brat has nothing to do with either of us, nor any beast she marries."
"What say you, Draco?"
asked Voldemort, and though his voice was quiet, it carried clearly through the catcalls and jeers.
"Will you babysit the cubs?"
The hilarity mounted. Draco Malfoy looked in terror at his father, who was staring down into his own lap, then caught his mother's eye. She shook her head almost imperceptibly, then resumed her own deadpan stare at the opposite wall.
"Enough,"
said Voldemort, stroking the angry snake.
"Enough."
And the laughter died at once.
"Many of our oldest family trees become a little diseased over time,"
he said, as Bellatrix gazed at him, breathless and imploring.
"You must prune yours, must you not, to keep it healthy? Cut away those parts that threaten the health of the rest." "Yes, my lord,"
whispered Bellatrix, and her eyes swam with tears of gratitude again.
"At the first chance." "You shall have it," said Voldemort, "and in your family, so in the world. We shall cut away the canker that infects us until only those of the true blood remain."
Voldemort raised Lucius Malfoy's wand, pointed it directly at the slowly revolving figure suspended over the table, and gave it a tiny flick. The figure came to life with a groan and began to struggle against invisible bonds.
"Do you recognize our guest, Severus?"
asked Voldemort. Snape raised his eyes to the upside-down face. All of the Death Eaters were looking up at the captive now, as though they had been given permission to show curiosity. As she revolved to face the firelight, the woman said in a cracked and terrified voice,
"Severus! Help me!"
"Ah, yes," said Snape, as the prisoner turned slowly away again.
"And you, Draco?"
asked Voldemort, stroking the snake's snout with his wand free hand. Draco shook his head jerkily. Now that the woman had woken, he seemed unable to look at her any more.
"But you would not have taken her classes," said Voldemort. "For those of you who do not know, we are joined here tonight by Charity Burbage, who, until recently, taught at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry."
There were small noises of comprehension around the table. A broad, hunched woman with pointed teeth cackled.
"Yes, Professor Burbage taught the children of witches and wizards all about muggles, how they are not so different from us."
One of the Death Eaters spat on the floor. Charity Burbage revolved to face Snape again.
"Severus, please, please."
"Silence,"
said Voldemort, with another twitch of Malfoy's wand, and Charity fell silent as if gagged.
"Not content with corrupting and polluting the minds of wizarding children, last week Professor Burbage wrote an impassioned defense of mudbloods in the Daily Prophet. Wizards, she says, must accept these thieves of their knowledge and magic.
The dwindling of the purebloods is, says Professor Burbage, a most desirable circumstance. She would have us all mate with muggles, or, no doubt, werewolves.
Nobody laughed this time. There was no mistaking the anger and contempt in Voldemort's voice. For the third time, Charity Burbage revolved to face Snape. Tears were pouring from her eyes into her hair. Snape looked back at her, quite impassive, as she turned slowly away from him again.
Avada Kedavra!
The flash of green light illuminated every corner of the room. Charity fell with a resounding crash onto the table below, which trembled and creaked. Several of the Death Eaters leapt back in their chairs. Draco fell out of his onto the floor.
Dinner, Nagini,
said Voldemort softly, and the great snake swayed and slithered from his shoulders onto the polished wood.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.